Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
Last year, the journalist McKay Coppins wanted to see if Rupert Murdoch's son James would talk to him. Now, Coppins had no idea what was going on in the family at the time, that there was this legal battle over the family trust. He just knew James had once been seen as a possible heir to his father's media empire and had since become something else, a dissident son.
I had this idea that James, as sort of the dissident son of the Murdoch empire, you know, the exiled scion, might have a story to tell. He had been inside the family business for 20 years. He had worked as an executive. He had, at various points, been groomed to be Rupert's successor. And then in 2020, he sort of out of nowhere resigned his seat on the board.
James Murdoch has resigned from the board of directors at News Corp.
News Corp owns the Wall Street Journal, known for its conservative editorial page.
Rupert Murdoch's youngest son said he was leaving because of disagreements on certain editorial content.
89-year-old Rupert Murdoch has counseled world leaders espousing his philosophy, but his son has moved to the left over the years.
News Corp publishes newspapers in the United States, Britain, and Australia.
And then that was it. And he never really explained himself. He never said what it was that led him to finally make this break with the family business. He never cited the exact editorial decisions he disagreed with. He just kind of went quiet. And so I had this kind of long shot idea that maybe he would be ready to unburden himself, to kind of finally tell the full story of what he'd seen inside the family business that so disillusioned him, and to talk about really what it's like to grow up a member of the Murdoch family. This like storied media family whose internal dysfunction has been the source of endless books and magazine articles and even, you know, movies, TV shows. What is it like to be in that family? So I kind of reached out to his press person on a lark, sort of expected that I wouldn't hear anything back, and then was surprised to find myself pretty soon after that initial email sitting across from him in a conference room in Manhattan as he told me what was happening in his family. And I didn't know when I first reached out to him that the Murdochs were in the midst of this really pitched, intense legal battle over the family trust and who would inherit the empire. But it turns out that when I reached out to him for an interview, this family was really melting down. And I think in some ways he felt like what his father was trying to do was liberating in a way. He had kind of kept his family's confidence for a long time and now felt ready to give his side of the story. And what happened from that point on was a year of conversations and interviews where he really opened up in ways that I was not expecting. I think that reporters often go into stories like this with a lack of curiosity. They kind of have a narrative that they want to flesh out. And so I didn't have that. I think I demonstrated some curiosity. I think also it helped that I didn't have much history with the Murdochs. There's like this whole cottage industry of journalists and authors and reporters who have made their careers out of documenting, chronicling the Murdochs. James actually kind of mockingly refers to the body of Murdoch literature as the canon. He really doesn't like a lot of those books and articles, and he doesn't see himself in them. I think he feels like he's often typecast as a certain kind of character, you know, the rebel, the contrarian. the black sheep of the family, and he feels like it's more nuanced than that. So the fact that I didn't have a lot of baggage, I had not really contributed much to the canon up to that point, I think actually worked in my favor, because he saw in me somebody who was coming to this story without a ton of preconceived notions. And so I think that's why he opened up to me. But like a lot of things in journalism, I also think it was luck. It was kind of being in the right place at the right time.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. McKay Coppin's story was published this past spring in The Atlantic. It's called Growing Up Murdoch. And at the time, we talked to Coppins about the story. Over the course of a year, James Murdoch and his wife, Catherine, talked about the emotional toll of Rupert's ambition for power and his influence and his role in orchestrating the internal rivalries in the family. Well, earlier this month, the Murdochs settled that long-running fight about who's going to run the family's media companies. The oldest son, Lachlan, is going to be in charge. His siblings, including James, got $1.1 billion in the deal and no say in the direction of the empire. So Rupert Murdoch's conservative media legacy is going to remain intact. Today in the program, we're going to replay our conversation with McKay Coppins, who told us James Murdoch was clearly fed up and disillusioned by the family fight. But he said James was also conflicted. I mean, furious with his father, but at times also protective.
This was one of the first things that I kind of latched onto and that made him seem like such a compelling subject, was that he really was sort of conflicted, right? Yeah. Like, he was clearly angry at his father and his oldest brother, Lachlan. And so you could tell that there was that anger that was kind of motivating him. But he also had this almost reflexive protectiveness of them. And I think this comes from a really natural place. I think a lot of us can understand having really complicated feelings about our family, but also wanting to protect them, right? Mm. But I think there's also something really specific about being a Murdoch, right? He had grown up in this family where there were certain ironclad rules that Rupert enforced. And one of them was that you never air the dirty laundry outside the family. You don't talk to reporters, especially reporters from outlets that we don't own. And so I could sense in my conversations with James some of those reflexes kicking in. He would start to kind of unburden himself or vent about something. And then when he sensed that I was a little too interested, he would pull back, right? Or if I asked a question that framed his father as kind of an antagonist or a villain in some ways, he would get quiet. And often his wife, Catherine, would start to speak up, right? His wife, Catherine, who he'd been married to for a long time, had been in this family herself for a long time. She had a lot of pretty strong opinions about how her husband was treated, how her father-in-law acted. But James would often kind of get quiet and nervous, and he would start tidying things up or doodling in his notebook. You could tell that he was uncomfortable with this on some deep level that I found really compelling and also kind of tragic.
It's also interesting that James Murdoch is looking at his family like he would look from as a scholar, as an historian. You mentioned he likes to think of himself as the student of dynastic dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And we'll come to his thinking about a particular Roman emperor here in a moment, but it does seem like he is thinking about his family in historical terms or maybe literary terms, that they fit into some kind of literary trope or something.
I thought that was also really interesting. And I think that part of that is him processing his own kind of family pain, right? Like, I think his particular way of processing all this was to not personalize it, but almost to make it sort of academic, you know, to like make it a thing that he could study and find historical parallels to or literary touch points that helped him understand what was happening to his family, to understand how his father treated him, etc. But he can't help but see these patterns in his family repeating over and over again. That was something that he realized. He said, you know, Tolstoy has that famous line at the beginning of Anna Karenina, all happy families are alike, each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And he actually disagrees with that because he feels like when he looks at the history of families like his, wealthy families kind of wrecked by money and power and greed, he sort of sees the same patterns replaying over and over again.
We have to say something about Succession, HBO Succession, for obvious reasons. But you mentioned in the piece that in your conversations with James and with Catherine, that the stories you mentioned started to have this kind of familiarity to them, like, as you put it, slightly altered forms of the series Succession. But it's more than that. Just talk a little bit about the connection here, because in some way, this is... It's not just an idea that the HBO creators, well, it probably is, are forming their ideas for Succession based on this, but there's more of a connection there. Explain it. It's a really interesting connection here.
So there was this weird thing that would happen to me when I was started to interview him, where I would feel like some story he told me seemed really familiar, and I would try to place it, right? I'd be like, was that in that Michael Wolff biography of Rupert, or was that in some Vanity Fair story I read from 10 years ago? And he would always say, no, I'm the only, you know, I've never told this story to anyone. And I'd realize that it was, oh, that was in an episode of Succession.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about Succession's interplay with the family, though, is that the Murdochs in general are kind of obsessed with this show. Yeah. And were from the beginning. And actually, that's pretty understandable in some ways. Like, can you imagine if HBO made a like critically acclaimed drama about your family? You know, like it would be hard to look away, as uncomfortable as it was. James always claimed to me that he had never seen it. He watched the first episode. It was too painful. He couldn't watch anymore. But within the Murdoch family, it almost became this kind of parlor game to guess which member of the family was leaking to the writers of Succession.
Right.
James and Catherine were convinced that James's older sister, Liz, was talking to the writers. She's actually works in Hollywood. Liz was adamant that she did not talk to the writers, but thought that her ex-husband had. It was kind of this whole thing in the family. Mm-hmm. I ended up, I should say, talking to Jesse Armstrong, who created the show, right. And he kind of laughed at it and said, I think there's a bit of a psychodrama around this whole thing, and insisted that there was no mole in the Murdoch family, that it was all based on kind of press reports. But what's interesting is that there was this kind of life imitating art, imitating life phenomenon that started to happen, where the Murdochs would kind of see things happening in Succession and assume that they were based on things that were being leaked by other members of the family, and then would therefore start to act as though what was happening in the show was resembling real life, right? And so, like, all the kind of on-air scheming almost fueled more real life scheming within the family and sowed distrust and paranoia within the family that in some ways I think led to this kind of breakup that's happening right now.
I mean, that's saying something, that the HBO series Succession, based loosely on the lives of the Murdoch family, actually impacted the lives of the Murdoch family. I mean, one of the things you write is that Rupert Murdoch is seeing Succession. He somehow becomes convinced that his real life kids are maneuvering against him based on the thing that he's seeing. And the fact that this show really defines where we are now with the family is kind of extraordinary.
It really is. And it's funny because early on, I sort of resisted the tropes of Succession. I had seen the show. I'd watched the whole show.
Yeah.
But then I was like, I'm going to very deliberately not rewatch the show while I'm working on this story, because I didn't want the journalism to be kind of affected by this very well done show. It's very well written. It's really evocative from the score to the way it's shot and the characters. But I was like, I don't want that to seep into this. This is journalism. This is, you know, nonfiction narrative. I want this to be its own thing. But it kind of became impossible to avoid Succession as a subject, because it became clear that this fictionalized television show was affecting real world outcomes. And I guess the only thing to say about it is it's kind of perfect for a media family like the Murdochs, right? Like the fact that what is happening on TV screens ends up being a kind of key driver in their own internal family dynamics makes a certain amount of sense when you look at the Murdoch family as a whole and its history and its place in the world.
Well, congratulations for working through the Byzantine story that is the Murdoch family. Let's back into it as you do in the piece and just start with the Project Family Harmony. Tell us what that is, because I think that'll give us sort of a background to get started.
Right. So Project Family Harmony began in 2023, and it was basically the code name given to a kind of set of plans that were made by Rupert and Lachlan and some of their advisors and executives to figure out how to rewrite the Murdoch Family Trust in such a way that would concentrate full control of the empire with Lachlan once Rupert died. Mm-hmm. As the trust is currently written, once Rupert dies, control over all the companies is split four ways equally between Rupert's four oldest children. That's Prudence, Elizabeth, Lachlan, and James. Rupert, believing that his three other children were secretly plotting against Lachlan to essentially execute a coup against him and take over the companies once Rupert was gone, decided that he wanted to rewrite the terms of the trust to make sure that Lachlan had full control. The problem with that is that the trust was established as an irrevocable trust, which means that no changes to it could be made unless Rupert could prove to a probate commissioner that they were in the best interest of his children. So Project Family Harmony was essentially a euphemistic code name given to a plan to disenfranchise three of Rupert's children in favor of Lachlan. And it's important to say here why Rupert wanted Lachlan to have full control. Yeah. And it really does come down to kind of the political influence of the Murdoch Empire, right? The Murdoch Empire consists of a lot of things. It's HarperCollins, the book publisher. It's a collection of TV channels across Australia, Asia, and the US. But primarily, it's known in the US for Fox News and maybe to a lesser degree, the Wall Street Journal. But it is seen as a key element of the conservative media in America. And Fox News especially has wielded enormous influence over Republican politics as long as it's existed. And so Rupert believes that James and his sisters don't truly believe in the conservative mission of Fox News and these other outlets, that once Rupert dies, their plan is to kind of boot Lachlan from the corner office, take over these outlets, defang them, moderate them, maybe sell them off as pieces, and destroy Rupert's life work. That's how Rupert sees it.
The idea that Rupert thinks of his life's work as connected to a particular ideology is really interesting. It's not that he sees the dynasty as having, you know, financial success. Like his worldview, his vision for the family business that he doesn't think James and his sisters are connected to is about ideology. Is that right?
Yeah. No, that's right. And this becomes very clear in some of the internal family communications that have come out in the discovery process of this lawsuit, which, by the way, is all supposed to be under seal, and none of this is supposed to be public, but a lot of it has leaked. The New York Times actually got a hold of 3,000 pages of documents from inside the lawsuit. I've obviously done my own reporting. But yes, it's very clear from these internal family communications that Rupert sees his project, his life's work, as being about providing a conservative counterpoint to what he considers to be the broadly liberal mainstream media in America, Europe, and Australia. I'll also say this, you know, James was not like, he didn't delude himself into thinking it was otherwise when he worked for Rupert. James it should be said, actually does have more moderate politics than his father and brother. He has been a major contributor to Democratic candidates, and he's supportive of climate change initiatives. That's one of his and Catherine's pet issues. And so they have a lot of problems with the kind of conservative politics espoused by places like Fox News. But if you ask James about this, he will say that it's always been nonsense, that this idea that he was going to come in and turn Fox News into MSNBC, right? His issue is that he feels like the way that Rupert runs these companies is unprofessional and reckless. And he thinks there could be a version of Fox News that still reports from a conservative perspective, still platforms conservative voices, but that has normal journalistic editorial guardrails. Yeah. And that it's as responsible as any other news outlet, and that he just feels like without an intervention, that's not going to happen. Rupert and Lachlan have shown no interest, in his view, in running the outlets that way.
McKay Coppins, he's a staff writer at The Atlantic. His story, Growing Up Murdoch, appeared in the April edition of the magazine. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, highlighting the flavors of fall with pumpkin spice in everything from bakery treats to favorite drinks. All things pumpkin spice are available at local Harmon's stores. harmonsgrocery.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're replaying a conversation with the journalist McKay Coppins. Back in April, he published a story in The Atlantic on the Rupert Murdoch family. Coppins got Rupert's son, James, to open up about his father's media dynasty, which had been embroiled in this battle over succession, but also fractured by a deep ideological divide. Well, the battle was settled earlier this month. The family reached a deal that James clearly seems to have lost because it locked in the conservative direction of the Murdoch media empire. Coppins' story is about what seems to be this shift in Murdoch's power and influence, but it's also just a juicy, gossipy story. It's the real-life version of Succession, of course, with all the betrayal and secret alliances you'd expect. His story is called Growing Up Murdoch. McKay, why is it so important to Rupert Murdoch to involve his family, to involve the kids? Because you describe this as his animating motivation.
It's a good question. This ended up becoming one of the key questions I was trying to answer for myself as I wrote the piece.
Because you would think he wouldn't care about the kids. I mean, he's successful or whatever, and they can do whatever they want. But that
right, to me, a normal way of associating your family life with your professional life, it would be, and I do this even with my own kids, right? I don't have nearly as much power or success as Rupert Murdoch, but I welcome them into kind of my professional world if they're interested. I tell them about the articles I'm working on, the books I'm working on. I bring them to events, right? Like Rupert, it was much more than that. He did all that, right? He would take his young kids on tours of the printing presses. He'd have them sit through dinners where he had various, dignitaries or politicians or media executives. But it was more than that because he wanted his empire from the very beginning to be a family business. He always envisioned leaving the company to his own kids and spent an enormous amount of time and energy trying to figure out which of his kids should be his successor. Why is that? I mean, it was a question that I had all the time. I've put it to James a few different times. I think that on some level, Rupert sort of felt like making this a family business is what was how he could extend his legacy into immortality. I think it was ultimately about his own ability to continue to exert influence even beyond the grave.
Let's talk a little bit about the family dynamic. I mean, the way you lay it out in the piece, let's talk about the sisters first. Prudence, you say, is the peacemaker. Liz is kind of the temperamental artist. Mm-hmm. James is kind of, and we'll talk more about this in a second, but he's sort of, he's typecast anyway. I think you put it this way, as the outsider, right? What's Lachlan?
Well, so Lachlan and James are born just 15 months apart. Yeah. Liz told me that they were treated almost like twins growing up. But Lachlan was the older one, and he was sort of always more self-consciously emulating his father. Hmm. He wanted to make dad proud. He wanted to be what his dad wanted him to be. And I think that in the way that a lot of families sort of typecast the various kids, James ended up kind of defining his identity and personality almost in contrast to his older brothers. Mm. Because Lachlan was the golden boy, James was the contrarian. He was the kind of rebel. Mm. And James admits that he kind of leaned into that identity in some ways, right? He pierced his ear. He got tattoos. He bleached his hair. He would get in trouble at school. At the dinner table, he would often be the one kind of asking these like needling questions to his dad to try to exasperate him. Mm. He was always the one kind of making trouble in the family, right? And I think he would say that, like, as a teenage boy, that was kind of his right, you know? Like, yeah. A lot of people go through a phase like that. I think that in the eyes of his father, at least, and maybe everyone in the family, he sort of never outgrew it, right? And that can be a real danger in these stereotypes that we sometimes end up with in our families. Like, you end up almost feeling like you can't escape the family stereotype of you. Mm. And I think James felt that way to a certain extent.
I felt sad for James as a kid. And it's ironic that Rupert Murdoch is conceiving of the family business, needing almost to involve his kids in the business, and yet at the same time neglecting them, ignoring them. You mentioned James spending his childhood in this incredible apartment, penthouse suite, I guess it was, in New York. He has a butler, but dad's not anywhere around for a lot of the time. So I felt sad for James.
Yeah, no, I did too. There's a lot of pathos in this kind of like privileged, lonely life that James was leading as a kid. There's this really funny story where James once asked his mom, "Is daddy going deaf?" Right. And his mom said, "No, he's just not listening."
Yeah.
And I think that kind of was the dynamic, right? Mm. Like, it's not that Rupert was intentionally cold. Yeah. Rupert was just very distracted, kind of uninterested in his kids' lives unless they were taking an active interest in him and his work, right? By the time James is 16, Rupert and his mother have actually moved to Los Angeles. Right. And James spends his teenage years in this penthouse alone, basically, with a butler named George. He doesn't see his parents that often. He would go weeks at a time without seeing them. He would describe when his dad would come to New York, it felt like spotting a celebrity.
Well, he's forced into the family business, and he sort of goes along because he knows what's expected of him. But maybe not much in those days is going to be expected of him. And then fast forward to having this success, you write about how he's sent to Hong Kong to take over one of these satellite TV companies in Asia, and he kills it.
It surprised basically everyone, right? It certainly surprised his father.
Yeah.
It surprised a lot of the people in the News Corp board because at this time, Lachlan is the one being groomed as the successor. Right. He's the oldest son. He's the one who clearly wants it. James has sort of reluctantly been dragged into the family business. And he gets sent on what a lot of people describe as a suicide mission. And to everybody's surprise, turns around this satellite company within a couple of years. It's profitable. And James actually finds in this experience that he's not only good at running media businesses, he actually kind of likes it. He likes it more than he thought he would. And then because he does so well, his dad sort of has no choice but to give him a promotion.
Well, he has this opening to sort of take over the running of the business, or part of it anyway. When Lachlan leaves in 2005, he gets fed up, goes back to Australia. This leaves an opening for James. Does he become the golden boy now?
It's complicated, right? Yeah. He definitely becomes the heir apparent at right. this point. Lachlan effectively taking himself out of the running because he's been squabbling with Rupert's lieutenants, like including Roger Ailes, who's running Fox News. He feels like his dad doesn't really have his back, gets fed up with the whole thing, quits and moves back to Australia. Now it's James. And the problem with this arrangement is that James is the obvious successor at this point.
Yeah.
He's well-liked, generally admired within the company. He clearly has some talent, but he has a very different kind of approach and worldview from his father. Mm-hmm. Not only politically, he does have different politics from his father, but he also has a totally different approach to running these companies, where Rupert is sort of, you know, reckless mm-hmm. and very excited to take big risks and sees himself as sort of like a pirate or a gambler and surrounds himself with executives who are like that as well. James is much more meticulous mm-hmm. and he wants to create healthy corporate culture, and he immerses himself in the language of kind of MBA schools mm-hmm. and the people he surrounds himself with are much more in that mold. And Rupert hates that.
Yeah.
It totally rubs him the wrong way, because Rupert, the whole mythology of the Murdoch empire is that they're almost kind of like the evil empire, that he has built this thing that everyone else in the media hates. And he's done it by defying expectations and breaking rules. And he almost delights in his own villainy. The fact that his son seems to want to be liked by the people that hate Rupert really bothers him. And so even though he makes James his kind of next in line and promotes him again, he eventually is running all of the company's operations in Asia and Europe. There is this clear wedge between them that is only really exacerbated as James becomes more influential and more successful.
There's this kind of weird thing that happens in 2010. Rupert Murdoch invites his kids to this retreat back home in Australia. It's a family counseling retreat. Like, on one hand, you want to think, oh, dad wants to get us together so we get along. Mm-hmm. But it just turns out to be, at least James thinks, a form of dad just is trying another way to manipulate all of us. Talk about this retreat.
Well, first of all, I should say, if listeners who watch Succession, their ears are perking up, it's because totally. This was an yeah. episode yeah. in the first season of Succession.
Right.
Yeah, so all the kids, all the adult children get invited to Australia for this family retreat. And it's really out of character for Rupert, we should just say.
Yeah.
Rupert is not a big believer in therapy, at least as far as James knows. This is a new interest of his. And the Murdochs are not a heavily therapized family. They've never been through family counseling before. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of already kind of deep issues within the family. But James is pretty skeptical of the whole enterprise. And at the beginning of the retreat, James kind of sits down with the therapist who's meeting with each of the family members individually before they begin. And he basically just says straight up, look, there's some stuff that you don't need to pick at. Nothing good is going to come of it.
Yeah.
And the therapist ignores that advice. And as soon as the family is reconvened, according to James at least, the whole session devolves into kind of gaslighting and recriminations and posturing, and everyone has their own story that they're spinning to try to garner strategic sympathy and advance their own agendas. Catherine told me that she thought the shrink was outmatched by the Murdochs and their capacity for manipulation. But what James told me is that everyone was more alienated from each other by the end of it. What he didn't know at the time, and only later came to realize after this kind of legal situation that the Murdochs are in surfaced all these internal family communications, was that Rupert at this point was worried about James's growing influence in the company. Mm. And apparently so were some of James's siblings. They didn't like how their little brother was kind of wielding his own power, seemed increasingly independent from Rupert. Maybe there was a little bit of resentment there, seeing their little brother kind of act like the heir apparent, the boy king, and they wanted him to be reined in. And apparently, at least according to James, this whole family counseling situation was really a pretense for the family to come together and stage sort of an intervention with James and tell him he needed to kind of slow down and start listening to his dad.
Say something about how Lachlan comes back into the picture. He becomes the golden boy again. How does that happen?
Well, in 2015, James is back in New York being groomed to take over as CEO. And one day at a lunch with the COO of the company, Lachlan is there and is kind of blindsided with the news that Lachlan is returning to the US, returning to the company, and that he's actually going to take over and that James is going to report to him. As you can imagine, James is kind of completely stunned by this news. He had no idea that Rupert was kind of secretly back channeling with his older brother to try to get him to come back. Eventually, after James threatens to quit, a new arrangement is made wherein Lachlan and James will effectively run the companies together with James as CEO and Lachlan as executive chairman. And for the next several years, they try to basically run the family business as co-leaders, and it does not exactly go smoothly.
People should read your story, because I'll jump over and get to the point where Rupert Murdoch, as people probably already know, and his son Lachlan lose that trial over the public trust. And what seems to be, to me anyway, one of the biggest questions of the story then is, what would the Murdochs' conservative news outlets look like if James had his way? So what do you think? Because I think what's interesting is you've got all of these incentives that James still has to sort of contend with. He is a moderate, but he also knows if he's going to make Fox News, let's say, or any of these other outlets successful, he is going to have to sort of rework his own principles because they don't always align with that.
Well, so what James would say to this is that Fox News doesn't need to be a non-conservative outlet to be a well-run, responsible media outlet, right? He says the reforms that he wants to see at Fox and at throughout the companies really have to do with corporate governance and editorial governance, right? Yeah. Fox News could still be a conservative news outlet without, for example, giving a platform to kind of quack doctors spreading medical misinformation during a pandemic, or platforming conspiracy theorists who say that the 2020 election was stolen. He has this just strong belief that actually it wouldn't be contrary to his principles to provide a responsible, reality-grounded conservative news outlet, that in fact, that's what our politics needs, right? There's always going to be a conservative political coalition in this country. Why not provide media for it that is making their understanding of the world better instead of kind of corrupting their coalition with these conspiracy theories and lies?
That's McKay Coppins. His profile of James Murdoch is featured in the April issue of The Atlantic. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we replayed a conversation with the journalist McKay Coppins about his story in The Atlantic on the unraveling of the Rupert Murdoch family. Coppins talked to James Murdoch, who broke the family code of silence. Earlier this month, though, the family reached the settlement that gives Lachlan Murdoch, the oldest son, full control of the business. James and his sister Elizabeth and Prudence each get $1.1 billion. But they relinquished their voting rights, which means Rupert Murdoch's conservative media legacy, which was so important to him, is going to be preserved. We caught up with McKay Coppins earlier this month for a reaction. He told us, despite all of the years of legal maneuvering and personal acrimony, the settlement didn't really change anything.
Lachlan was always Rupert's favorite, always the one that Rupert wanted to run the empire when he was gone. And there was always this kind of lingering hope among certain people, liberals, centrists, even some people inside the company or close to the family, that when Rupert was gone, his three more kind of liberal children would link arms and overthrow their right-wing brother and, you know, defang Fox News and reform these media outlets. And I don't think that was a total fantasy. Like, I really did think it was a possibility, but I also knew from my reporting that if this latest maneuver failed, Rupert wasn't going to just give up. I always had the sense that Rupert was going to find another way to get what he wanted. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, he got what he wanted. He just had to write three very large checks.
Right. So you write in the Atlantic piece that Rupert Murdoch from the grave wanted to manipulate and govern not just his media outlets, but the politics of the countries where they're most influential. And he's 94. It seems like he won. It seems like he's going to get his way. And by that, I mean the way the settlement has come out, he will still be able to rule that empire in some ways kind of from the grave. Like he won. Is that right?
I think so. He got exactly what he wanted. He secured the future control of his media empire in the hands of the one son who is guaranteed to keep it on the course that it's on. Mm-hmm. Lachlan is even more conservative, more aligned with the kind of Trump-era populist conservatism that's overtaken the English-speaking world, and is certainly Rupert's best bet to keep this media empire together and keep it standing for the right-wing ideas and voices that it's become synonymous with.
What did James get? James and his sisters, Prue and Liz. It seems like the basic answer is they got money. Is that fair?
Yes. They each walk away with $1.1 billion. I guess if you were looking for a silver lining beyond the money, you could say that this chapter of their family life and of their individual lives, which is really defined them in a lot of ways and defined certainly the Murdoch media assets, the succession drama is finally ended. And I could imagine that, you know, maybe that comes with some peace of mind. At the same time, at least when it comes to James, who is the one that I spent the most time with and who I profile for The Atlantic, I have to believe that it's going to be difficult for him to watch his brother run these companies that he devoted a considerable portion of his own adult life and career to building and steering them in ways that are just antithetical to his value system, his beliefs. I'm sure there will be 100 decisions made every quarter for the rest of his life that he disagrees with. And he's just going to have to live with that. And I guess that's the price he's paying.
It's so interesting because he didn't need another $1 billion. He has plenty of money. What he seemed to want to do is shift the tone of his father's media empire. But I guess at some point he just realized that was not going to happen. And he, I guess, just conceded the point, I suppose.
I think he realized that. I should say this first. I haven't spoken to James since this decision was made. He's keeping very quiet.
Right.
So this is speculation based on my many conversations with him and reporting. But I think he saw the writing on the wall, realized that he wasn't going to win, and decided to wash his hands of the whole thing. Right. You know, I don't know exactly the dynamics that were at play. I always got the sense that he would be willing to hold out for a very long time with the hope of being able to kind of reform these companies. But I did not necessarily get that same impression with his sisters. And so, you know, I do wonder if the kind of pressure built to the point where James just realized that there was no point in holding out any longer and he should just take the buyout.
In the reporting about the settlement itself, your article comes up, at least it did in the New York Times, because James had gone on the record with you. The reporting says it unwittingly gave Rupert and Lachlan an opening because, you know, he had disclosed this confidential information to you. So Rupert Murdoch's lawyers asked the judge to consider a new trial. What do you make of that? Did your article, do you think, in any way affect the outcome of the larger case?
Yeah, I mean, this is always kind of an uncomfortable moment when the story that you're covering, you end up becoming even kind of a bit player in it inadvertently. There is kind of this meta element to the story where it does appear, based on the reporting in the New York Times, and I've subsequently confirmed it with my own reporting, that the publication of the Atlantic story in February of this year did seem to change the state of play in the litigation between Rupert and Lachlan on one side and James and his sisters on the other. You know, as a reporter, that's really not the business I'm in. Yeah. You know, I'm not trying to sway the outcome of a court case or litigation one way or the other. I tried to do the best I could to understand him, his family, what they were going through, and what the stakes were. And I wrote it all down, and we published it when it was ready to be published.
You mentioned in the piece that when Rupert Murdoch dies, that he's going to leave behind a family at war with itself. Is that still the case? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been settled legally, this
yeah.
but have the family relationships been repaired in any way?
I thought it was telling that in the reporting about how this deal came to be, there was no suggestion that Rupert and his children all got in a room to hash this out. It was their various lawyers and representatives hashing it out at the Harvard Club and going back and forth over the legal details. I seriously doubt that it's all water under the bridge and they're all going to be hanging out on Christmas. I don't know for sure, of course, but I will tell you that when I was last kind of really spending a lot of time talking to certain members of the family and doing reporting on this, the two sides were so far apart, but they weren't as far apart on kind of what the outcome was that they wanted for the business. There had been a lot of pain and a lot of bitterness. They were just really divided against each other. This legal process had surfaced kind of years of lies and scheming and manipulation, and I don't think it's so easy to get over that. I mean, to me, that is ultimately the kind of the tragedy of this whole story, that like they've reached a deal. The succession question has finally been settled. Three of the kids get to walk away $1 billion richer. Rupert and Lachlan get what they want. But you have to ask the question, what was it all for? This deal would have been on the table a year ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago. If Rupert and Lachlan wanted to buy them out, they could have made them a serious offer a long time ago. Instead, Rupert took a path that essentially wrecked their family.
Final question. I want to come back to the thing we were talking about at the beginning of the interview and the question of how much will the media landscape change, because it doesn't seem like it will much now. One of the big questions you wanted to get at with your article was, what would Rupert Murdoch's conservative news outlets look like if James had his way? Mm. And I guess the answer now is we will just never know, because that's not going to happen.
That's right. The great promise of a post-Rupert Murdoch empire was that there could actually be this experiment in building conservative media outlets that adhered to traditional journalistic standards, had editorial guidelines, had healthy corporate cultures. I mean, this was the stuff that James was kind of preoccupied with. And it's not going to happen. The way Lachlan is going to lead these companies is an open question. I mean, certainly he's going to keep them conservative. He's going to keep them as profitable as he can. But, you know, this settlement is taking place at the same time that one of Rupert Murdoch's large media properties, the Wall Street Journal, is locked in a battle with Donald Trump, right?
Over they the Epstein published, files, yeah.
Yeah, they published an Epstein-related story that Trump really tried to convince Rupert not to publish. And there was this kind of newsman instinct that kicked in with Rupert, right? Where he stood by his newsroom and stood against a president that he had helped get elected and had championed in many ways. And, you know, speaking as an outsider here, that is what you want your media moguls to do, right? I don't know if Lachlan is going to have the stomach or interest to do that same thing in a similar scenario when Rupert's gone. Lachlan doesn't seem all that interested in journalism. He doesn't seem to have the same kind of giddy fascination with newsrooms and getting big scoops. And I think that if he doesn't have the same newsman instincts that his dad has, I think that'll be a big loss for the American media landscape in general.
McKay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
McKay Coppins. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. His story about James Murdoch is called Growing Up Murdoch. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. We're on Instagram at Radio West. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.